You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1989 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is an evening lecture given by Brother Randy Tyra, titled, A Common Quiet Soul.
I just noticed you're all wondering why I would want to talk about a common quiet soul, that not being generally associated with me. Well, that's just the way it is this time. The particular psalm I chose for this lecture is very short. And again, you may wonder why I chose such a short psalm. Well, I chose such a short psalm because it was the only one appropriate. The psalm is appropriate for reasons of an historical nature. Many years ago, Brother Mark Giordano, who's with us this time, took that psalm out of the Revised Standard Version and wrote music to accompany it. He wrote a lovely melody for it. And because I sang the song so often, I finally got to the point where I'd actually memorized it. It took me a long time, but I had it well. But I did memorize the song, and I've always loved that psalm. I could never figure out exactly why Mark chose that particular psalm to put to music, but I've thought about it a lot since then, over the last 15 years, this psalm. In the Revised Standard Version, it's more like, O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not concern myself with things too great, too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul. Like a child in its mother's breast, I have calmed and quieted my soul. Now, I think in the last couple of years have begun to grasp the implications of what David was singing about there. You see, David was like most of us. He had some rather prepossessing enemies, and we have some fairly prepossessing enemies of our own. His enemies were Philistines and varying times his sons and other people like that, and he had a very difficult time battling them. Our enemies are somewhat of that same nature. We have sin and death. We battle against sin, and we find that sin is too bright for us. It's very subtle, it's very deceitful. And we're just not geniuses. We're not capable of combating sin on its own turf. And we find death an equally deadly foe. Death is strong, mighty, it brings us all low at the end of our lives. And so we find ourselves faced with two indomitable foes, sin and death. And what do you do when you're faced by two enemies that you can't beat? Well, you noticed it this week. You notice people like Lon and Joe running back to her mother, and you notice Adam and Joel Eichel running back to their mother. That's what gets me about that song. He's describing the only appropriate reaction when you're in a situation where there's no way out. You run to somebody else to take care of you. You know, one of the little kids sees some large, brutish person like myself wandering around, they get terrified, and they say, Mommy, and they go running off, and they hide behind their mother's skirts, or in their mother's breast. And they're comforted, and they're calm. And David, before overwhelming foes, we do the same thing with his God. And we, at this time, when we find ourselves overwhelmed with the present distress, the troubles that are associated with trying to walk uprightly and well this side of the kingdom, well, sometimes, in fact, all the time, the only thing you can do is run to your Savior and say, just take care of me for a while because I'm really not up to this. Now, I wanted to use that as the basis for what I say because there's a... Well, let's go to Job chapter 6 and we'll see what there is. In Job chapter 6, the first five verses are really lovely. I'm reading out of the New International Version, so this will be close to whatever you have out there. Job replies and says, If only my anguish could be weighed, and all my misery be placed on the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Does a wild donkey bray when it has grass? Or an ox bellow when it has fodder? I really like what Job is saying there. He seems to be saying, in I thought, friends, it doesn't matter whether I'm a sin or not. I'm suffering right now. He says, does a wild donkey bray when it has grass? The ox bellow when it has fodder? Doesn't matter. I'm suffering. I'm in pain. I'm in anguish. I've lost my family. I've lost my wealth. I've lost my health. You come to me with all of your cravings about sin, about what I've done, what I should be doing. And he said, I don't need that right now. Job sounds to me very much like a person who could have used a stiff dose of Psalm 131 this very moment. He doesn't want to have things explained to him. He doesn't want anyone to walk up to him and say, well, you know, from my vantage point, looking at your situation, I'd say your condition is this. Job, you did such and such and such, and you forgot such and such and such, and you blew it. You just didn't need to hear that. And I love what he says in verse 6. Is tasteless food eaten without salt? Is it flavor in the white of an egg? I refuse to touch it. Such food makes me ill. He says, thanks a lot, guys. All the stuff you tell me makes me sick. It's like the white of an egg. Maybe there is nutrition in it, but I don't need it. I don't want it. I don't want this tasteless food without seasoning. You're not helping me. You're not feeding me. Get away from me. Now, the reason I'm thinking about this, about comforting people in times of suffering, is something has happened to me twice in the last, in a two-day period of time, about 2 weeks ago, I had two very strange occurrences happen to me. The first happened while I was at work. I've been at my new job for about 2 weeks now, and several people there know that I'm a believer. And one lady walked up to me, and she just started talking to me. I knew her several years ago, and she says, I know you're a religious person, and I want to know. I've got a friend, and it's a person I know, this other person. She said, her husband died, cancer. And she tells me she just doesn't want to hear about God. She said, it couldn't be fair. She says, she just doesn't want to hear about God right now. Why did it have to happen to him? And so I quickly whipped out a stack of standard Christadelphian ideas about why people suffer. You know, I didn't actually get to them all. I never got to John 9 about that it was done that God's power might be manifest. But I talked about the problem of sin in the world. That's not a personal thing, you know, that people die. You know, somebody's got to do it, and it just happened to be him this time. I talked about that you can't blame God when these people die, when these horrible things happen to people out there. That this is the consequence of their own actions, that people over the last few thousand years have done many terrible and ugly things. And that, well, that's why people die. We do all these horrible things. We've incurred these things because of our sins. And then I said, that people learn. There's a lesson that the world has to learn. It really is. That God can't really intervene right now and alleviate all the suffering and all the pain, because it would be wrong. It would be wrong if God alleviated the pain, because people would then believe that they could sin without suffering the consequences. So God can't do it. He's got to let them suffer the consequences of their evil. Let them know they've done wrong, and that doing wrong makes people hurt. And you know, I got done with all that, and I could tell about maybe 30 seconds into what I was saying that I kind of lost her. Her eyes kind of rolled up. I just lost contact. And it bothered me, because I thought, well, I'm saying logical, sensible things here, and I'm telling her the truth, and she's not getting it. She just doesn't understand me. Secondarily, I got a letter from a young girl who's one of my Sunday school students. And she's been traveling recently, and she had a couple of really disturbing events happen in her life the last year. One of her schoolmates was killed in a traffic accident in Africa, got smashed in a bus, a 14-year-old boy. And she was disturbed very much by that. And then a little bit later, she was going down to the swimming pool. They have a pond that's in the swimming pool in Africa, you know. And she was walking over there. And when she got there, a woman came out running and screaming about, I think he's dead, I think he's dead. And by the time she got there, there was a body on her, shore of the lake. The guy drug a person out who had been in the pool and didn't know how to swim very well. Artificial resuscitation didn't help. I died. So I had a 14-year-old girl who was faced with death. And she said something to the effect of, God must have a reasonable answer to this. I just don't know. And what disturbed me was I've talked to her about these things over the past 2 or 3 years while she's been my Sunday school student. And it disturbed me, this, that I'm talking to people about suffering and about the anguish that they have in the world, and I'm not getting through to them. And idea. I couldn't understand. Why don't they understand what I'm telling them? And no, this is so clear. These are biblical truths I'm explaining to these people. Well, I think this is the part that's weak. Because I think I understand what's wrong with me, but I'm not positive. Let's turn to John chapter 17. I hope you noticed I said what's wrong with me and not what's wrong with them. In John chapter 17, verse 11, he says, Jesus, praying to his Father about his disciples, rather, says, I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world, and I am coming to you, Holy Father. Protect them by the power of your name, the name you gave me, so that they may be one as we are one. And Jesus says, I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world. Starting in verse 15, he says, My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. In verse 18, As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. Now, I've been thinking about that a lot recently. And what struck me is that I've got a discontinuity between my thinking and what it says. It says we are not of the world, but we're in the world. Well, I must have failed grammar someplace, because I don't think I've really got that clearly fixed in my head. I seem to read it, and what I come out with is, I'm neither in the world nor of the world. The world doesn't have a whole lot to do with me. Now, what I'm saying is I think I've forgotten that I'm part of the world. You see, what's happened over the years is I've developed a really strong antipathy for the world. The world's a bad place, it's ugly. It's what kills people, what causes disease, it has all these horrible things. We talk about the world and the spirit and the flesh and all these things being in combat. And the world is our enemy and such. And I've been seduced into believing it. But the world is my enemy. I've got to fight that thing and get away from it as best I can. But I seem to have forgotten that, well, this is commonly quoted, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. We say that all the time. I think most of us actually understand. Maybe I just was slow and didn't quite get it. God loved the world. His desire wasn't to save a couple of people here and there. He wants the whole thing. God is not willing that any should perish. He wants them all to come to repentance. The world is God's. He made it, created it, as Mark's been talking about all, going to talk about all week, I hope. This is his thing down here. God loves it. His desire is for the world that be his, that his glory be manifest in it, and that it look the way he wants it to look, that we behave the way he wants us to behave. He wants to make this thing something special. I mean, God created man upright. We've sought out many devices. But he made us upright, and he made us here in the world. He made the whole thing. He may have corrupted it a bit, but it's his. Romans 5:8 says, God demonstrates his own love for the world in this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The thing that's compelling about this is the concept that the righteous dies for the unrighteous, and it's not righteous people that are being saved, it's not good people that are being saved, it's us. No, it's the bad guys that are getting it. But it's just people in general. Christ died for sinners. Christ died for the world. God wants to save the world. God so loved the world. What am I doing hating it? What am I doing trying to separate myself from the world? Trying to distance myself from this thing so much? Am I missing something? Is there something I don't have quite straight in my head? Well, let me quote to you from another psalm, and I'll explain the lack, possibly, in my own reasoning. This is a verse that affected me very much when I first read it. Psalm 116. In verse 8, the psalmist says, For you, O Lord, have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet to stumbling. Now, the first time I read that, I did cry. I mean, it really got to me. Now, maybe not the first time I noticed that, probably better. I did cry. It affected me greatly. Because what I like so much is that it's so simple. He's gotten down to the very basics of what's happened to us in our salvation. He says, God, you've delivered me from being dead, from grief, and from being confused and foolish, you know, stumbling around, getting into trouble all the time. He says, God, you've delivered me from these things. I was going to die, and now I'm not. I was subject to grief. So many terrible things happened. There was nothing I could do. So I cried. And I stumbled because I was perplexed. I didn't know the way out. I've been delivered from that thing. Now stop and think for a second. Look at the world. You know what the world is? People who haven't been delivered yet. And that should make you care about those people. Think of the difference between that person out there and me in here. His soul has not been delivered from death, nor his eyes from tears, nor his feet from stumbling. He's going to die. That's enough right there to make you feel pretty bad, especially him. His eyes have not been delivered from tears. There's no surcease for his grief. When one of his friends dies, when his wife is sick, when his child is hungry, there's nothing he can do about it. The world just pounds you. It's just the way it is. That makes you cry. And there is no respite for that man, or for that woman, or that child. And there is confusion. They are not delivered from stumbling, because there's no wisdom out there for them. You know, I think that's the sum total of the difference between them and us. We're very alike in our behavior, in our thought patterns. That's another thing that was brought out this morning. You notice that the thought pattern of the world, that lovely branching thing, that's a gift from God. The way they think isn't that they developed that for themselves. God gave them the capacity to choose, gave them the capacity to think. They fouled it up, but it was his gift. They think like us. That capacity to create disorder and chaos and disaster was God-given. And sin and corrupted, but it was God-given. They need to be delivered from their foolishness. Delivered from their anguish. Delivered from their imminent doom. That's the difference between that alien and ourselves. Now, I remember that when I was initially considering this, the first thing that popped in my head was, wait a second, I know those guys out there. They're scum. I mean, I live outside of Oakland. It's bad in there. Drug dealers all over the place, and nasty people, and killers, and pimps, and prostitutes. Oh, really bad. And I just got back from El Salvador, and it's even worse down there. You know, you see a lot of people walking around with one leg, because the other got blown off. And the moral standard is low. They kill people all the time. Bombings going all over the place. Machine gun fire. I couldn't believe it. I heard machine guns almost every day. It was like regular in the background. Hour after hour, people shooting each other. It just happens. That's the way it is down there. Unfortunately, that's the way it is in about 80% of the world. I was thinking about it a while back. There's a lot of wars going on. There's a lot of corruption that's out there in the world. And I stopped and I thought, well, wait, you know, I know the world, and there's nothing lovely about it. So why should I care about something so vile and so corrupt that is destroying itself, it's eating itself alive? After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many. Now that's what it says in Isaiah 53 about Jesus. It says, by his knowledge, he will justify many. Now, you wonder, what knowledge is he talking about? Is it the knowledge of the prophets? Is that considerable learning in the law of Moses? Was that the knowledge that was going to justify many? Was it his understanding of the complexities of the coming events? As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. I don't think it's that he had great scriptural knowledge, even though he did. It wasn't his tremendous capacity to interpret prophecy that enables him to justify many. It was his knowledge of human nature. His knowledge of what we are. His knowledge of how we came to be what we are, how we're formed. And his comprehension of the fact that we're just dust, that we're all sinners, that we're all weak, and we're all going to hell in a handbasket. He understood that. He said, I comprehend that. And you know what he had compassion because he understood that. He says that specifically about Jesus. John chapter 2. He says, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. The knowledge that Jesus had was knowledge about those around him, about those evil Israelites, those fastidious Pharisees, all of those people that surrounded him and eventually were going to kill him. He knew them. He understood them. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. But now that you know God, or rather, are known by God, how is it that you are turning back to those weak and miserable principles? That's in Galatians chapter 4, verse 9. It says, not that you know God, but now that you are known by God. That's what's happened to you when you get baptized. That's what happens to us when we come to know Christ. It's that we get known by Him. Now, the reason this is so, I think this is so important, is because, well, listen. There were some psychological studies that we've done a while back. I don't know when exactly, because I've forgotten. I don't have it with me. And someone came to the conclusion that the most terrifying thing that happened to a person, or in general, was believed to be having to speak in public. You know that's true because you saw me here last year. The thing is, I really think that whoever phrased that question must have phrased it wrongly. I don't think it's right. I'm sure some psychologists would disagree, but I don't think it's right. You know what I think is a really great fear that every single person has? At least I hope every single person has it. I think it's the fear of being known. Really known. I project an image. I know, I mean, I've got an image. It's good. I have an image. People don't know me, they know my image. I project that, I hold it in front of me, I present it to people, I say, hello, meet image. Works really well. I do it all the time. I do it every place. It's not funny because it's not unique. Everyone does that. We all present a face to the world. Why do you do that? Because you have the deep abiding fear that if anybody really knew me, they'd hate me. If they knew what scum I'm really, like inside, you know, the little worms crawling around inside my psyche, if they could recognize those things and see those things, they wouldn't like me. They wouldn't want me around. If they knew the sins that I did years ago, they'd despise me. They'd say, get away from me. We have 5 billion isolated people here in the world. Everybody hiding out someplace saying, oh, woe is me. I don't want you to know what I'm like inside. That's what makes what I've just been talking about to me one of the most profound scriptural concepts I've ever come to, well, at least try to come to grips with. It's the concept that Jesus knows me. He knows me fully. He knows me all the way through, and he doesn't hate me for it. He does not despise me knowing my vile little sins. He does not put me aside understanding my petty little mind. I'm dazzled every time I think of that. I go, how can you do that? Because I'm petty. And I'm not really very nice. How do you do that? But he does. He knows me. And I admit I don't understand it. Because it's something that does not come naturally to me. I know very well, if I knew any of you perfectly, I probably would like you anyway. But I know that not one person here believes that. You're terrified at the thought of anyone knowing that deep secret, that great sin that you've got hidden. In fact, what I find almost overwhelming about it is this. In Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, Now, we always quote this verse to try and disprove the concept of a personal devil. But I'm sure it's teaching a few other things, too. He says, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. And over to chapter 4, verse 15. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. The compelling thing those two verses teach me is this. First, Jesus was made in our image, like us. He shared our humanity and all of these things. Secondly, that it's only because he shared that, and because he does know us, that he does love us. He has compassion on us, not because he doesn't know what's wrong with us, but because he does. What does it say about the high priest? We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. Or the obverse, we have a high priest able to sympathize with our weaknesses, who has been tempted every day, like as we are, who shares our humanity, who knows us perfectly. This is the basis for the love he has for us, for the compassion that he shows to us every day in letting us survive, in letting us live. It's based upon the fact that he does know us. Not that we've been able to hide our sin and our corruption from him, but that it's been laid open, laid bare before him. Herman's been talking about that clam at the end of time when he's going to open it up and look inside. He's already done it. He's looking in right now. The great thing is, he's having compassion on us, despite the fact there's no garden inside. Despite the fact that we're full of corruption. Now what this tells me is what's wrong with me in relationship to those people who are outside with whom I cannot commiserate. Remember, this started off with a little thing about a little girl who wrote me a letter. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't explain to her what's wrong with the world, why people suffer. Started off with a friend of mine named Gail who has a friend who had a husband who died. And I couldn't understand how come I lost her when I tried to talk to her about suffering and why bad people suffer and why it's so bad out there in the world. We know it's wrong. We read in Psalm 103 that he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. I think I forgot that. Jesus knows my frame. He remembers that we are dust. That we are all united in that fellowship of death. But I've forgotten that. I've separated myself from the world. I really do think that I'm a little different than they are out there. I don't remember my nature. I think I'm different from them. I've forgotten where I came from. I've forgotten that I was delivered from death, delivered from tears, delivered from stumbling. I used to do that. I used to cry. I used to stumble. I used to have a fear of death. I've been delivered from that. I am not foreign to that. It is not alien to me. I participate in that. At this moment, I have been saved from it. They haven't. You see, I lost my compassion sometime along the way. Sometime in the 20 years since I got associated with Christadelphians, I lost it. I lost the fellow feeling. I lost the understanding that we're all in this world together. I can't get off the planet. I'm not an astronaut. I'm stuck here. I lost that. I really started to believe my own breath clippings, that I was, we're a superior body. That God has called us out of the world and transported us to his heavenly kingdom. Well, he did. You notice he didn't move. You were transported spiritually. You have been placed in a heavenly place by his point of view. But you're still in the world. You are no longer subject to death, but you're still going to die. He's going to wipe away every tear. He's going to put your tears in a bottle. But not just yet. You're still subjected to grief. And you're still subjected to confusion. Just like them. One of our great politicians in his election campaign, he made a reference that was absolutely nonsensical when he said it, and everybody laughed at him, but it should apply to us. He spoke about 1,000 points of light, and I laughed my head off. But It should be us. You see, there's just a few thousand of us in this country, but what should we be? Should we not be small points of compassion and grace, existent here in an ugly world? I'm not here to separate myself from the world, to cut it off, and to avoid it. I'm here to help in its process of delivery. I'm here to be a redeeming savor of salt. Salt of the earth, because that's what he says we are. I'm here to understand those people outside and grant them what I can. What I lack when I talk to these people about suffering is a fellow feeling. I forgot that they are just like me. I was just like them. That I share their sufferings and their grief. I'm saved because Jesus shares my sufferings and my grief. Because he knows exactly what I am and he loves me for it. Can I do any the less for them? Yeah, there are killers out there. And there are rapists out there. And there are some bad people out there in the world. Believe me, none of the impulses any of them has is foreign to the impulses common amongst us. We're the same. The fact I kill no one does not make me superior. The fact I'm not a rapist does not make me better. Maybe it just means I never had the opportunity. I have no idea. But I will tell you that we are the same. And that knowledge and that acceptance that we all share one flesh, that we all share a common motivation, that's the only way we'll ever communicate with those people out there. The realization we are not a royal priesthood yet. That we are not their superiors, we're not kings ruling over them. That what we've been granted is an insight and an acceptation into God's kingdom. We've been delivered. And now it's our duty, our responsibility to turn and provide that same thing for them. Thank you.